Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 90 years old, but he sure doesn't sound like it, especially if you hear him singing alongside his wife in their church choir in Colorado Springs, Colorado. When he was in the 82nd Airborne at the end of World War II, nobody would have predicted that this paratrooper would end up as a legendary Air Force general with over 500 combat missions, not to mention ridiculously dangerous work as a test pilot. General Robert Titus is our guest today, and when we left off, he was flying F-51 Mustangs in the Korean War. But before you left Korea, you transitioned to one of the early fighter jets, the F-86 Sabre jet. What was that like?
It was pretty simple. They sent us to southern Japan to go through training on the airplane, all of its systems, hydraulic systems, electrical systems, and so on, so that we'd know what the airplane was all about. My first ride, they gave me a ride in a T-33, two-seated trainer. That was my first time in a jet. When I landed from that, they said, okay, there's a Sabre jet. You can get in that and fly it. And we're going to give you 10 hours. If you can't cut it in that 10 hours, then we don't want you. And I think it was my fourth ride when I was flying number four in a flight of four. And we were flying north, and I remember flying over a river and looking down, and I said, that looks like it might be the river that we're not allowed to cross. But we did. Then suddenly we were going the opposite direction. Leader turned south in a hurry, and I'm strung out number four. I said, I guess I'm checked out. It looks like we're in the combat area. Anyway, the airplane's in front of me, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I said, no, I'm 4. 3, 2, oh, that one out in front must be a MiG. But the lead had not made any radio call. It turned out that he had radio failure. And the MiG just zoomed up and turned north. And had I known he was going to do that, I think I'd have stayed high and tried to intercept him. But that was my first vision of a MiG and my first combat mission in F-86. And I had about 4 hours of flying time in it.
Yikes. And like you say, nothing really ever gets to you as you describe that. It's no big deal, but listening to it, it sounds like a really big deal. Could you feel the difference in power, in speed, and was that difficult to adjust to?
I'll just have to tell you that prior to that checkout, when I had been in Japan, the group commander sat down at our lunch table with us one day, and he said, I need some jet pilots for the 94 squadron, F-94 squadron. And one of the guys at the table said, I've got some jet time. And the colonel said, how much you got? Oh, I got about 15 hours. He said, oh, okay, you can go to that. Next guy had something like 9 hours. Oh, yeah, you can go join that squadron. I said, I'd like to do it, too. You got any jet time? No, sir. Well, then I couldn't use you. I said, are you going to tell me, sir, that it's harder to fly a jet than it is a Mustang? Well, you have to understand, it's an entirely different concept. And I'm thinking, I don't understand. And I don't know how I'm going to learn to understand. If I can't fly the airplane until I get some jet time, how does that work? Will it work differently in combat? There's the airplane, go fly it. So there was nothing to it. I thought they'd been lying to me. I landed that thing, and I said, this is a kiddie car. It's the easiest airplane I've ever flown.
And so you continued to fly those over there in combat till the end of the war?
Yeah, until I finished 100 missions, and then they sent me home.
Anything about those F-86 missions in Korea stand out?
I never got up airborne. There were any MiGs up other than that first mission. I never saw another MiG, and it seemed like they weren't flying the days I was up. Unfortunately, I was looking for them all over the place, but never had the opportunity to engage MiGs in Korea.
And here you had been in the World War II victory parade in New York City. The Korean War, there was no victory.
No, and it was a shorter war, of course. I recall after the Vietnam War, being in Washington, and somebody saying to me, look at this terrible Vietnam War memorial, 50,000 troops, and that terrible. And I said, well, it took 10 or 12 years to do that. Have you ever been over to Gettysburg? It's only about an hour's drive, and you can see what we did to one another in 3 days. So war's bad.
Korean War comes to an end. Any disappointment on your part with the way it ended?
No, not really. You know, the only disappointment was when I got home and read the newspaper that the MiGs were up and guys were, friends of mine were shooting down MiGs. I thought, I left too soon. But other than that, the war went on for another year. And when it ended, I was pleased. I thought it was a lousy war, but then I guess I feel that way about all wars.
Yeah. Well, does that mean that you enjoyed being a test pilot more than flying in combat?
Oh, I enjoyed flying tests, and I was fortunate to be able to get that kind of a job. I flew aircraft across the North Atlantic to NATO countries for a year or so before I got orders to go to the test pilot school. That was a feather in my hat. It was something that I was seriously interested in. I accidentally found out that there was a test pilot school when I was stuck at BW1 in Greenland. We had ferried aircraft, as I say, we were taking them to Europe via the Northern Polar Route. This was before we had aircraft in-flight refueling, so we were doing hopping from base to base. We'd leave Bangor, Maine, and fly to Goose Bay, Labrador, and from there to BW1 in Greenland, North Sarsawak, Greenland, and from there to Keflavik, Iceland, and then down to Prestwick, Scotland, and from there over to the continent, be it to Norway or Denmark or Holland or Belgium or France or wherever we were delivering the aircraft. Anyway, we were stuck in Greenland. We had lost four airplanes between Goose Bay and Greenland one day and lost a couple of pilots. Anyway, we were stuck there while they were doing the accident investigations, and I was bored beyond reason. We didn't have anything to do all day long, play bridge and ping pong until they opened the bar. I went down to the headquarters building and started looking at personnel regulations, and I found out about the test pilot school. And I filled out an application and sent it off on a teletype machine right then and there. A couple of months later, I was told that I was accepted to the test pilot school.
That was at Edwards?
Yeah. It's referred to now as the golden days of flight test. We learned a lot that we didn't know anything about. We lost airplanes in the process. We learned about pitch up. We learned about adverse yaw. We learned about what we shouldn't be doing with airplanes that were pretty iffy.
Do you have to be a little nuts to volunteer for that duty?
No, you just have to be fortunate enough to be able to do the academics and understand the processes. And if you have a little skill, you can stay alive.
Was that kind of exciting for you to do something that no one else had done before?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought we had the best job in the Air Force. We had 10 fighter pilots in flight tests. While I was there, we lost 15. People say, how do you lose 15 out of 10? So you keep getting new guys.
It's like those infantry units in World War II.
Pretty much.
So I know that you tested a lot of different jet aircraft, but I read that you had a zero-length launch test where an F-100 is rocketed from a truck bed by a 300,000-pound thrust booster attached to the fuselage.
Actually, it was 130,000 pounds of black propellant. Yeah, it was.
What does that feel like?
It's a 4G acceleration. When you pull the trigger, you're already in full military power, and you stroke the afterburner. Now you've got all the power that the airplane's capable of generating, but you're held in position by some shear bolts, which don't shear until that 130,000 rocket booster lights off. And that just shoves the airplane forward and runs it out to about 275 miles an hour in 4 seconds. So it presses you back against the seat pretty strongly, like an elephant stepped on your chest.
Yeah.
And then you're flying. The rocket drops off of its own accord. The airplane is flying. Yeah, it was a very interesting flight test program.
And what's this transpolar flight from England to the U.S. in an F-100?
I was given two aircraft, two F-100s. They had an analog computer installed, which was a dead reckoning computer, which presumably would give you an ability to move from point A to point B and follow the indication of the arrow, because the computer simply figured out your position. You'd plug in where you wanted to go, and it would give you that indication. And I thought, I've got to do something with this. What can I do? And I thought about a polar flight, because we were told you can't navigate in the polar area because you don't have the capability, you don't have all the necessary equipment, you don't have a sextant, you don't have this, you don't have that. And fighter pilots are too dumb to be able to navigate anyhow. But, of course, we know better than that.
And this is 1959, a long time ago. And this was your idea?
Yeah, I had these two airplanes, as I say, and I thought, well, a polar flight might be a good idea. So I had a tech rep, and we got together, and I laid out some polar charts on the ground and figured, well, I'll just put a grid over them, a grid overlay, and then I can tell the computer, okay, we'll start here, and we want to go there, and it'll solve the equation. And, well, there's a guy by the name of Charlie Blair. He's a famous navigator pilot who had done a P-51 flight over the pole from Norway to Alaska a couple of years prior to this. And he came out to Edwards on some other business, and I invited him over to the house for dinner, and I put my charts on the floor and showed him what I'd like to do. And he thought it was a great idea. And he said, well, you got two airplanes. Can I fly the other one? I said, I guess you can. And so we got the program approved, and that was an arduous process because my boss said, no, we don't want to do that. That's somebody else's job, not a flight test job. His boss thought it was a good idea. His boss didn't, and we're going. Finally, I'm talking to the general who asked me, a question about it and invited me to his office, and he called Charlie Blair. Charlie Blair was a great guy. He was married to Maureen O'Hara, by the way.
Oh, really?
The movie actress.
Yeah.
That happened later. And anyway, we did this flight. He turned 50 while we were doing the flight. And then we managed to do the trip. It was a 9.5-hour flight, and we were arrived at Anchorage, Alaska, 1 minute off the projected arrival time.
Did you see anything along the way or encounter any surprises?
No, it was a piece of cake. Getting the flight approved was the hard thing. I was told by the navigators at the headquarters in Washington, D.C. that, well, you can't navigate in the North Pole, you know, the magnetic compass doesn't work. I said, yeah, I know that. Well, how are you going to navigate? I said, I'm going to use a directional gyro. Well, the directional gyro has random precession. I said, yes, I know that. Well, what are you going to do about that? And I said, I'll update it with a sun compass. What do you know about a sun compass? I said, I take a picture of the sun, and I look at the almanac and reset the gyro. Well, what are you going to do? How are you going to do that in weather? I said, there's not going to be any weather at 35,000 feet. It was an interesting experience. What was most interesting about it was I went from the headquarters out at Andrews Air Force Base to the Pentagon, where I was going to meet Charlie Blair. And Charlie was in the office of the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development. And I went into the lobby of the Pentagon, picked up the phone to call that office, and I intercepted a telephone call. And it was Dick Horner, the president, the guy who's the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, talking to General Anderson, who's the head of the Research and Development Command. And he's saying, Sam, this is Dick Horner. I got Charlie Blair in my office, and he and this Captain Titus, from test pilot from Edwards, want to do this flight, and your people turn him off. I don't know anything about that, but I'll sure put an end to that. Anyway, I went up to Horner's office. As I went in the door, out came Charlie Blair and said, we've been approved. I said, I know. What do you mean you know? How do you know? I said, I know that the telephones aren't secure.
And am I correct in interpreting that the reason it was so hard to get that approved was that if anything did go wrong, if your navigation is off or if you encounter any trouble, you're really out of luck?
Well, we could have landed at Thule, although it was 0-0 there. That would have been a tough job. Thule, Greenland. But, you know, I don't know why things were approved or disapproved. There are people that are totally antithetical to any proposal that comes out of the box. Perhaps because they don't have an interest in it, or they're resentful that somebody's doing something that, who knows. But persistence wins in the final equation, and we were persistent.
Clearly, you're a persistent guy. But if you had gotten lost, or God forbid, if you had gone down, there probably wouldn't have been much chance for a rescue in those kinds of conditions.
No. In fact, I mentioned that we lost four aircraft between Goose Bay and DW1 Greenland that time, and it was February, and the guy that was leading my flight took off with zero oil pressure in 0-0 conditions, zero visibility, zero ceiling. And we were 100 miles off short of Greenland when his engine quit. And a sheet of flame came out the back end, and he jacked it. But there was an undercast below us, and I saw his parachute descend through the undercast. But no one ever saw anything of him again. So, that, you know, that's, again, part of the deal. You either make it or you don't.
Yeah, and it's clear that you became accustomed to that trade-off pretty early, and you had a lot to go. I know I'm just scratching the surface here. When the Vietnam War broke out, was that something where, because of your combat experience in Korea, you were eager to get over there and fly combat missions?
I was eager to get over there, yes. It took me a while. I was at headquarters, Tactical Air Command at Langley Field, Virginia, and I was working for the Deputy for Operations, General Gordon Graham. One of the things that I was involved in was putting together an F-5, Northrop F-5 Freedom Fighter deployment over there to evaluate the F-5 in combat. And I was the project officer working for General Graham and putting that thing together. And the unit was sent over there temporary duty, presumably for 90 days, with a big evaluation team to gather all the data. It was decided at the end of that program to extend the unit's term, make it a permanent installation, fill it up with additional aircraft and more pilots. And I had a call from the personnel guys, and I went upstairs to their office, and he said, I thought you'd be up here in less than a minute. Look, here he is, and here's a job you might want to be the commander of that outfit. And I was just before making lieutenant colonel, and the lieutenant colonel's job is a squadron commander in those days. I went down and asked the general, and he said, no, wrong airplane. And I asked him to think about it, and I come back tomorrow. Remember, he said to me, well, you should be flying Phantoms. I said, I can do that later. He said, what will your wife say? I said, we won't tell her. So.
And you didn't?
And didn't tell her. But anyway, I got the job, and I was really looking forward to that. I've been asked many times, what's the best job in the Air Force? And I said, squadron commander of a fighter squadron in combat. So I was able to command the Scotia Tiger outfit, and then I extended so I could fly Phantoms north.
Yeah, and you flew 400 combat missions in Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. 400 and some. I don't know how many, to tell you the truth. Some of them I didn't think were worth counting.
That's an eye-popping number.
I'd just the odds. If they'd let me.
I know you would. But just, I mean, when you step back and think about the odds, I mean, you've already survived over 100 missions in Korea, crazy stuff as a test pilot, 400 missions in Vietnam, taking your life into your hand every time.
Well, that's not my call.
You really did enjoy that work.
Yeah, it's a great job. It's the cutting edge of the sword. You're where it is. Serratius at the bridge. It's being there.
If you have 400 of them, there's no one that's typical. But can you give us a taste of what some of those missions were about or like?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's hard to go back. And, of course, shooting down that first MiG-21 was a great experience.
Well, we're going to hear about that experience when we come back. He would earn the Silver Star for those actions in the skies over Vietnam that day, and 2 days later did something that brought him an even more exclusive decoration, the Air Force Cross. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of General Titus and links to those medal citations. And we'll hear the rest of his remarkable story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.